statement, and we'll proceed to the sixth case, Fincher versus South Bend Heritage. Mr. Hull.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Kent Hull on behalf of the appellant Marshall Fincher. We appeal from the district court's ruling that Mr. Fincher, as an applicant for Section 8 housing benefits, does essentially not have a cause of action pursuant to this court's earlier decision in 1984 in Eidson versus Pierce. At the time the Eidson court ruled, it recognized that it was explicitly disagreeing with the Court of Appeals of the Ninth Circuit. There was at that time effectively a conflict between this circuit and the Ninth Circuit. Since Eidson, the Eighth Circuit has followed Eidson, and the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, the highest court of that state, has rejected Eidson. We are therefore in a position where there is a conflict between the Seventh and Ninth Circuit, because the Ninth Circuit hasn't changed its mind, as well as a conflict between this circuit and the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts.
But of course, it's a very long-standing conflict, and this court doesn't usually, once we've made a decision, we follow principles of stare decisis, and if the Supreme Court were interested in that conflict, it seems like they might have done something about it.
I'm not sure that they had the opportunity to do something about it, Your Honor. I'm not sure whether this court has ever been asked to look at Eidson again.
Well, you wouldn't have to. When the Eighth Circuit ruled the way it did, somebody could have filed a petition for cert, or somebody could have filed a petition for cert on a question of federal. Of course, the problem with your analogy to Massachusetts is that, as I understand the Massachusetts case, the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts was applying Massachusetts law, which has different features to it than the federal statutes that this court was looking at.
There were some distinctions in the Massachusetts situation. However, the Massachusetts court, in the Madera case to which Your Honor is referring, specifically criticized the Eidson case and suggested that Eidson itself was in conflict with other decisions of the Seventh Circuit. So obviously we're in a situation where Section 8 housing applicants, if they live in the Ninth Circuit, can sue, but if they live in the Seventh Circuit, they can't.
Let me be more precise about that, though, because in some ways that's true, but the set of claims that this court said could not be advanced in Eidson were the claims that really went to how a landlord is going to choose people for a limited amount of space. Now, certainly, if a landlord announced, "I'm taking no African-American applicants," or the like, the Fair Housing Act would protect that person. They can bring a lawsuit. They can get their rights vindicated. So it's not, we want to be careful that we're not overstating the scope of Eidson. Eidson is focusing on a particular kind of due process claim that was raised with respect to the United States Housing Act. And the thought was, when you were simply an applicant, that for this private entity, there was no due process right, or for that matter, a public entity. If you don't have a constitutionally protected right, just as cases like Sandin against Connor say, for prison libraries, et cetera, then all the rest of the due process machinery doesn't get triggered.
You're correct on both points, Your Honor. First of all, if there was a violation of a separate statute, like the Fair Housing Statute prohibition against racial discrimination, disability discrimination, Eidson would not protect
it. Yeah, Eidson doesn't speak to that. So applicants for Section 8 housing enjoy a certain set of protections, just not this particular thing, which our case said isn't triggered by. You don't have enough of a property interest in a unit that you don't have yet.
The difficulty with the second part of Your Honor's point, which is that the Eidson court distinguished between the rights of applicants versus the rights of recipients. And the
Right. Okay. So once you're in the apartment, you have some kind of protectable interest.
Right. And the trend of the law seems to be, since Eidson, and this is what the Madera Court in Massachusetts said, that the courts, and the Supreme Court has not explicitly ruled on this yet, the courts have tended to protect more and more the applicants and to apply the Goldberg versus Kelly principles.
But didn't the court there rely on the state program, which had clearly defined legal criteria for the application process, whereas here it's left at the discretion of the owner of the facility?
Well, clearly the state program in Massachusetts was more detailed with respect to criteria, and the Madera Court did look at that.
And that's very important for a due process claim, because there are criteria that a court is capable of assessing.
However, Your Honor, the Madera Court also recognized that the so-called discretion of the landlords is not nearly as broad as perhaps the Eidson panel thought that it was.
Well, not in Massachusetts, it isn't.
Well, even if one looks at the Ninth Circuit situation, there are significant limitations on what landlords can and cannot do.
But didn't this court already look at the Ninth Circuit situation?
Oh, it did, and it explicitly, that's
right.
Why we have a conflict.
Right, but if you're asking us to rely on that, they've already looked at it and disregarded or distinguished it.
And of
disagreed.
Course, as I understand the case law of this circuit, this panel has the authority to relook at Eidson if it wants to. And
well,
some
you're only partly right about that. If we were persuaded by your argument, which you're certainly entitled to make, our Circuit Rule 40E would allow us to inform all the rest of the members of the court
right.
that we think another look is necessary, and the court as a whole would decide whether further argument was called for, whether briefing, whether it wanted to move. So, you know, you're allowed to say, take another look. It's an uphill battle, but you're certainly permitted to say it.
The second part of our argument in the district court was not only that Eidson was incorrect. I mean, of course, the district court had to follow Eidson, and Judge Simon recognized that, and he recognized in his opinion that we were planning to challenge Eidson. The second part of our argument was based on the contention that Mr. Fincher was the intended third-party beneficiary of a contract between federal government and the housing provider with whom he was dealing. And I should say more precisely that his third-party beneficiary status derived from the existence of the statutory and regulatory scheme.
Was there a contract at issue there?
Well, I don't think there is, Your Honor. The appellee says there is, and that we didn't designate it under Rule 56 and the local rules.
Can you have a third-party beneficiary if you don't have a contract?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the Lloyd case, which is an older case in this circuit, the recognizing a private right of action under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, the court looked at statutes, federal statutes, which create programs of which people benefit, and whether educational programs, and it's our position that those statutes and regulations themselves create the third-party beneficiary rights. I will conclude at this point and save my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Mr. Miller?
May it please the Court, I represent the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation, our position, we would respectfully suggest that there is absolutely no conflict between this state law decision in Massachusetts and the court's prior decision in Eidson. The Madera case stands on its own. It was construing a very specific Massachusetts state statute where the discretion of the landowner was closely prescribed. An applicant could be denied admission to the project for only one of eight enumerated bases. Here, under the Housing Act, broad discretion is provided to the private property owner to make a determination as to the suitability for tenancy of the variety of applicants.
So it's your opinion that a private property owner under the federal statute could say, I don't want anybody who's been evicted in the last 5 years, not just the last 3 years, or I don't want people with children, or how far does that discretion go?
Your Honor, I believe that you could not make a determination that no people with children, because that, I think that that would run afoul of some of the Fair Housing Act regulations, because that goes to familial status. The issue of is 5 years too broad a determination for a prior eviction, I think that that's a much closer call, and I think that that probably would be permitted because of the broad discretion otherwise acceptable, the language that the Eidson Court keyed on. So, yes, I believe a eviction within 5 years would be a basis for denying the application for tenancy.
Mm-hmm. Now, does your organization have a contract with the Department of Housing and Urban Development?
Your Honor, that issue, I believe that they do receive governmental funding for the rehabilitation projects to kind of turn blighted properties into tenable housing for low-income people. A lot of them are also mixed-use residences, where a portion of the apartments do go for market rates, and then there are some that are set aside for Section 8 tenants. That goes to another issue of
But as far as you know, there's no contract that's pertinent to this. I mean, I'm sure you don't just, like, open the mail one day and discover a large check from HUD in it. I mean, you must have some formalized arrangement with them.
That's true, Your Honor, and I believe that that was one of the concerns of the district court under the third-party beneficiary claim that was made, is that on this motion for summary judgment that my client filed, there was absolutely no contract that was designated by the appellant to establish the third-party beneficiary claim that they were making.
Well, he thinks the HUD regulations establish that there's enough of a relationship to show that the tenants in the Section 8 housing are intended beneficiaries of this regulatory scheme. What do you think of that?
Your Honor, we disagree with that position. The HUD regulations are quite clear in the amount of the discretion that is afforded to private landowners, and this court in Eidson recognized that. Also, I think that that issue really goes to eligibility for the program, Section 8, as opposed to entitlement to the benefit. Now, the question that Eidson recommends is, if we do provide a hearing, if due process provides that there's an obligation to provide a hearing, what's the purpose of that hearing? And that goes to the entitlement to the benefit to the apartment, because my client cannot be compelled to rent an apartment to accept his application for tenancy and to provide him with an apartment. That is, the Housing Act does not strip the private landowner of discretion in selecting among the various applicants for the apartments. And that's really the heart of the matter.
So and this case is all about hearings, right? It's not otherwise about rights to the Section 8 housing?
Your Honor, it is absolutely entirely about whether or not Mr. Fincher was entitled to receive a hearing on the denial of his application. That is the one issue. And to advance that issue, Mr. Fincher brought two claims, the third-party beneficiary claim and the Housing Act claim. And the no contract was submitted on the motion for summary judgment. The appellant hasn't pointed to any regulation, any Housing Act provision that provides him with being a third-party beneficiary. And under the Housing Act claim, the Seventh Circuit, the Eidson opinion is absolutely crystal clear.
To be arguing not only is it clear, but you, I presume, are arguing that it's well enough reasoned that we shouldn't ask our court to revisit it.
Absolutely, Your Honor. This circuit has considered and previously rejected the Ninth Circuit reasoning in Ressler. Nothing has changed in the 25 years since this court decided Eidson. The appellant has presented absolutely no novel argument that wasn't apparently also considered by Eidson. The two Ninth Circuit cases upon which the appellant rests is the Ressler opinion and the Geneva Towers Tenants Organization. Both of those cases were considered by this circuit in reaching the conclusion in Eidson. The Geneva Towers case is 10 years older than Eidson. The Geneva Towers case also, interestingly, that was a present tenants. That was the basis of the Ninth Circuit finding that there was a property interest is because that they were current tenants. But interestingly, Geneva held that due process does not require that those tenants be provided with a hearing. All that they were obligated to provide to satisfy the strictures of due process was that they be notified in advance of a rent increase, be provided with the opportunity to submit objections in writing, and also to receive a concise statement as to the basis upon any rent increase. So even the Ninth Circuit recognized that a current tenant, somebody with a property interest, wasn't necessarily obligated to receive a hearing. So I would respectfully suggest that these issues have been previously considered by the Seventh Circuit. There has been absolutely no change in the last 25 years. The circuit thoroughly considered the reasoning of the Ninth Circuit and rejected that. The Seventh, Eleventh, or the Eighth, Eleventh, and Fourth Circuits have followed Eidson. The Ninth Circuit stands near alone in its reasoning, and the Massachusetts State Court opinion is simply comparing apples to oranges. That was limited to a state statute. Unless the court has additional questions, I'll yield the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Hull?
May it please the court, very briefly, if the Massachusetts court decision in Madera is so distinguishable, why did the Massachusetts court spend so much time talking about Eidson and why it's wrong? Second, there is no question that today we have a conflict between at least two circuits, 7 and 9. The only way I know to resolve that is to get one of those circuits to change, to ask the Supreme Court to resolve it, or to go to Congress for legislative change. Pardon me. Third, the issue that we have, if I may finish.
Of course, you until the red light goes on, Mr. Hull, that's just a point.
Oh, is that his red light?
No, there's another.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'm sorry. All right. Very briefly, if I may say it, that what Mr. Fincher thought, Mr. Fincher went to Southland Heritage, said, I want to move in here. They said, oh, you've been evicted from the Southland Housing Authority. That's the end of it. That was his due process. I thank the court for its attention.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hull, and thank you, Mr. Miller. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.